You're listening to the Liberty News Radio Network, and this is the Political Cesspool. The Political Cesspool, known across the South and worldwide as the South's foremost populist conservative radio program, and here to guide you through the murky waters of the political cesspool is your host, James Edwards.
Headed down south to the land of the pines. I'm thumbing my way into North Carolina. Staring up the road and pray to God I see headlights. I made it down the coast in 17 hours. Picking me a bouquet of dogwood flowers. And I'm hoping for Raleigh, I can see my baby tonight. So rock me, mama, like a wagon wheel. Rock me, mama, any way you feel. Hey, mama, rock me. Rock me, mama, like the wind and the rain. Rock me, mama, like a southbound train. Hey, mama, rock me.
A contemporary take on some of that old-time Southern-style music. Welcome back to TPC this Saturday evening, first day of May. And we were going to wrap up our annual coverage of Confederate History Month last week, of course, with it being the last week of Confederate History Month. But there's never an inappropriate time to celebrate who you are and your heritage. And so we just decided on the fly tonight that we would extend it by one more hour. And the reason for that is, well, a couple of reasons. The one I just mentioned, and then also the fact that we had intended to spend 2 hours doing it last week, and Keith had some things last week he was going to bring to the conversation that we didn't get to, and we figured, well, we'll just, we'll let it slide. You can't get to everything, but now, no, we are going to revisit it one more, and we're only a day past April, right? I mean, so it is only May 1st. So, Keith, if you can even remember, what did you have in mind relative to this topic that we were going to cover last week but didn't have the chance to do as a result of the verdict being handed down and that dominating the program?
Well, quite frankly, I'm glad that we had time to put things off because everything that we've been talking about, we're talking about the black riots based upon supposed white police brutality. We're talking about the what was the name of that article earlier today?
The singles epidemic.
The singles epidemic. All of this stuff tracks back to the Civil War, particularly racial conflict. And, of course, racial conflict led to Brown versus Board of Education, which was the first volley in the singles epidemic that we have. People stopped having children like they used to because they were going to have to send the children to private schools, and they couldn't afford to send as many children to private schools, which charged tuition, as they could to send to public schools, which were free. So everything is interrelated. And again, race is at the key, the middle of it. What happened in the Civil War, it's really obvious from what we've read earlier in this month, in April, about Jefferson Davis's contemporary account written shortly after the Civil War, that the current narrative that the Civil War was all about slavery and black people was a fiction. That's not at all what was motivating people in 1861. It didn't motivate Lincoln. It didn't motivate the people of the South that seceded. What actually motivated people was economic exploitation. The South was, remember, back then there was no income tax. That was against the law. It was unconstitutional. The Constitution specifically prohibited it. That's why they had to pass the 16th Amendment during the Woodrow Wilson era in order to allow an income tax, because otherwise it was prohibited. Well, the question then becomes, how did the federal government get revenue to run itself before the 16th Amendment and income tax? Well, the answer is excise taxes. That's what the Whiskey Rebellion was about in the 1790s. Western Pennsylvania farmers, hill farmers, couldn't make a living off of their corn crop unless they converted the corn into whiskey. And then the federal government decided to tax the production of whiskey, and that led to the Whiskey Rebellion. Well, other excises involved the, what you would say, tariffs on foreign manufactured goods, which the South, being an agricultural region, had to buy in order to induce the Europeans, the British, the French, the Germans, others, to buy their agricultural products, primarily cotton and tobacco. Back then, nations did not tolerate trade imbalances. If Europe was going to buy our cotton and tobacco, we had to buy their manufactured goods. And the people in New England knew this, and as a result, they taxed foreign manufactured goods, were constantly looking to increase the size of the tariff. That's what the Tariff of Abominations was about in the early 1830s. That's what the Morrell Tariff, which was really what pushed most of the South into secession in 1861, was about, increasing the tariff on foreign manufactured goods. When the Virginia delegation met with Lincoln to try to head off the secession of Virginia, Lincoln's first words were not, "What about slavery?" His words were, "What about my tariff?" They wanted that tariff. That's how the federal government was run. And Lincoln was very clear that all he wanted was tariff revenues. What he said about South Carolina seceding was they could secede as long as they continued to pay us a tariff on any foreign manufactured goods that came into their territory. Of course, no sovereign nation could agree to that. But he knew that. And he also tried to provoke an armed response. We had a phony war period in the Civil War, just like you had the phony war period in 1939 at the beginning of World War II. And they finally provoked the hot-headed South Carolinians into firing on Fort Sumter. Nobody was killed by Southern fire. There was one Union soldier killed when the Union troops were leaving Fort Sumter. They decided to fire off a salute with one of their cannons, and the cannon backfired, exploded, and one of the Union soldiers that was working the cannon was killed. But see, that's all that he needed to do that. He wanted to bring the South back in, because otherwise the North was going to have to finance the federal government. And he didn't, you know, that he knew that wasn't going to sell. The North had already threatened to secede back during the War of 1812 and before then. Over financial things. So when did everything become about slavery? It became about slavery on January the 1st, 1863, with the Emancipation Proclamation. Let me just go through this real quickly. The reason was, it became increasingly apparent both to Lincoln and the Confederate leaders that if the Confederacy was going to win the war, they were going to have to, like the American revolutionaries in the American Revolution, have to have a major European power join the war on their side. Britain was the logical party for that, because they were the major trading party for cotton and tobacco. So how did they work that? We'll tell you all about that after these words from our sponsors.
Okay, girls, about finished with your lesson on money?
Daddy, what is a buy-sell spread for gold coins?
Well, when you sell a gold coin to a coin shop that's worth, say, $1,200, you don't actually get $1,200. But don't worry, we're members of UPMA now, so we don't have to worry about that.
Daddy, what if somebody steals our gold?
We don't have any gold at the house. It's stored safely in the UPMA vault, securely and insured.
But the S&P 500 outperformed gold. Daddy, gold is a bad investment.
Some people do think of it that way. But actually, gold is money. And as members of the United Precious Metals Association, we can use our gold at any store, just like a credit card. Or I can ask them to drop it right into Mommy and Daddy's bank account, because we're a UPMA member family. Find out more at upma.org. That's upma.org.
Why don't we say to the government writ large that they have to spend a little bit less? Anybody ever had less money this year than you had last? Anybody better have a 1% pay cut? You deal with it. That's what government needs, a 1% pay cut. If you take a 1% pay cut across the board, you have more than enough money to actually pay for the disaster relief. But nobody's going to do that because they're fiscally irresponsible. Who are they? Republicans. Who are they? Democrats. Who are they? Virtually the whole body is careless and reckless with your money. So the money will not be offset by cuts anywhere. The money will be added to the debt, and there will be a day of reckoning. What's the day of reckoning? The day of reckoning may well be the collapse of the stock market. The day of reckoning may be the collapse of the dollar. When it comes, I can't tell you exactly, but I can tell you it has happened repeatedly in history when countries ruin their currency.
You know where the solution can be found, Mr. President? In churches, in wedding chapels, in maternity wards across the country and around the world. More babies will mean forward-looking adults, the sort we need to tackle long-term, large-scale problems. American babies in particular are likely going to be wealthier, better educated, and more conservation-minded than children raised in still industrializing countries. As economist Tyler Cowen recently wrote, quote, by having more children, you're making your nation more populous, thus boosting its capacity to solve climate change. The planet does not need for us to think globally and act locally so much as it needs us to think family and act personally. The solution to so many of our problems, at all times and in all places, is to fall in love, get married, and have some kids.
Running from the cold up in New England, I was born to be a fiddler in an old-time string band. My baby plays a guitar, a big banjo now. All the North Country winters keep forgetting me, and I lost my money playing poker, so I had to wipe it away. But I ain't a turning back to live that old life no more. So rock me, mama, like a wagon wheel. Rock me, mama, any way you feel. Hey, mama, rock me. Rock me, mama, like the wind and the rain. Rock me, mama, like a southbound train. Hey, mama, rock me.
It's funny. I was given a speech in Nashville some years ago, and we walked over to a bar across the street from the hotel, and it was me and a lot of our people and supporters, and that very band walked in the bar unannounced and just got on the stage and just started singing that song. I mean, it wasn't a concert venue. It was just a little hole in the wall, but those people at the Old Crow Medicine Show walked in and started singing that very song. So anyway, well, let me say this with regard to slavery, what you were saying in the last segment. It obviously was a issue. It was an issue. You can debate as to whether it was the issue or just a tangential issue. It was certainly going to die out with mechanization and industrialism and all of that. And I think everybody knew that. But it would be apocryphal to deny the cornerstone speech or in the fact that some of the declarations of secession, the states were interested at least for a time in preserving it, but it was not to me the issue. Race is an issue, but I'll tell you, the South was right about race. And what I don't like to see is the defenders of the South and even the defenders of the Confederacy, what few there are, who will say, well, no, you know, they try to recast the Confederates as proponents of some sort of a rainbow nation, that try to recast them in this ridiculous light. No, they were not in favor of that any more than the founding fathers of the country were in favor of that. And we know that if you go back to the original immigration laws and who could own land and who could vote and who was a citizen and all on and on and on. But that's okay. My point is, we have to own it, and I do own it. They were right then, and what was right then is still right now. So that's another little sidebar. I don't like the people who try to recast the Southern heroes as something that they were not.
Well, you're absolutely right on that regard, but let me just say this. Slavery was a minor issue. Not only was it a minor issue for Lincoln, in fact, he ran from the issue.
Until 1863, when he needed he needed some public relations to help stem the...
Well, it wasn't just public relations. Here's what the problem was. The big question was, will England join the Confederacy in this war? He had to do whatever it took to do it. Give him credit for being sly and, diabolical. Here's what he came up with. He said, England is unique among all the nations of the world at that time by legislatively abolishing slavery. That's what they did. They did that in 1833, 30 years before 1863. 30 years is not a long time, folks. There were still a lot of Englishmen who had, they thought, fought the good fight to abolish slavery. And if the war suddenly became about the preservation of slavery or its abolition, then that segment of the English population would be very opposed to England joining the war on the side of the Confederacy. Lincoln knew that. That's why he did what he did. Okay, that's why suddenly, January 1st, 1863, the reason for fighting the Confederacy and resisting their secession was to abolish slavery.
Well, and this is another thing that is true. You would be fooling yourself as well. On the other hand, the opposite point of what I was trying to make, and it's also true, all wars throughout history have been fought over land, money, and power. If you think that the Union soldiers were fighting to free the slaves, that's a completely absurd notion.
In fact, Joseph Hooker's Army of the Potomac, when the Emancipation Proclamation came out, they almost mutinied. They said, this isn't what we're fighting for. We're fighting to preserve the Union. That's how the argument was cast up until January 1st, 1863. Furthermore, abolitionists were a very, very, very small part of the northern or southern population at that time. Basically, you had two types of abolitionists. You had abolitionists who were abolitionists because they loved black people. That'd be like William Lloyd Garrison. It would be like John Brown. It would be Harriet Beecher Stowe. On the other hand, the majority of abolitionists in the North at that time were abolitionists because they did not like black people. People like David Wilmot, the author of the Wilmot Proviso, that wanted to keep slavery out of the new land gained in the Mexican War by the United States. And the reason was he thought the South had polluted the nation by bringing in black people, and he held a grudge against them. That's what motivated the people that created the American Liberation Society, trying to take blacks. I think it started in the early 1820s or 30s. And they were moving them over to what became the nation of Liberia. And the capital of Liberia is Monrovia, named after James Monroe, a former president of the United States that was instrumental in founding that American Colonization Society. So the spin that is being put on the Civil War by the left is blatantly false. And you can look at the historical documents. You can look at the... There's no better source than Jefferson Davis's book that he wrote after the Civil War about the causes of the Civil War. He quotes chapter and verse in all the deliberations of the Founding Fathers and on up, everything else up until the war. Lincoln's comments when he was on the campaign trail, all of these things, they belie the lie of the left that the Civil War was about race. However, what is undeniable is that since the Civil War, what has happened...
Not necessarily race, but slavery.
Well, slavery was race, okay? Race was slavery. That's why, so if it had been a bunch of white people being enslaved, I doubt that the left today would be all worked up about it. And there were plenty of white people enslaved. In fact, white people were enslaved by Africans long before Africans were enslaved by white people. That's what the Barbary pirates were about. They used to go up and down the coasts of Europe, kidnapping entire villages, killing the old men and women, and getting the young men and making them galley slaves, pulling oars and whatnot on their galleons, and the women as sex slaves and harems.
But this is another thing about slavery, too. I mean, we're told, all of the pre-Columbian Indian tribes were just wonderful. Well, the Aztecs, I mean, we've talked about this a lot, but just in one example of the Aztecs, when they were christening, well, not christening, but when they were opening one of their new temples, they had 20,000 slaves that they just butchered. And butchered to commemorate the opening of this new temple. That's 20,000 slaves. But they were great people. They were enlightened. They were a civilization worthy of preservation. But you talk about Southern slavery where, by contrast, I certainly wouldn't have wanted to be a slave. But relatively speaking, as far as slavery is concerned, the Southerners weren't ripping their hearts out and throwing them downstairs. They typically provided food and shelter for them. It wasn't a good life, but it was. If we're going to compare apples and apples, let's do it.
Quite frankly, you can even argue that it was a good life. Let me just say this. If you want to see how to mistreat a slave, look at the East African slave trade to the Arabs. Right. Yeah. Okay. What they did, they used these slaves, among other things, for being harem guards. So they gave them the males complete castrations. That's not just like a vasectomy. That's the whole apparatus going. And because the whole apparatus is a vascular organ, about 2/3 of the people that was done to died from loss of blood. But that's why they don't have an indigenous population of black people in the Arab nations, because they could not reproduce. Now, black people in Africa were enslaving each other long before the Europeans got involved in the situation, too. So let's keep all of that straight. Basically, the left, starting with Israel Cohen back in 1912, saw race as the Achilles heel of American society and said the way to convert America to Marxism is through racial conflict.
Okay, well, I hear the music, so we're going to take a quick time out, and we'll come back with Janice Hamblin. Janice Hamblin, one of our good friends and regular contributor to some of our special series here, and we'll talk to Janice next as we wrap up Confederate History Month a day late.
Pursuing liberty, using the Constitution as our guide. You're listening to Liberty News Radio. USA Radio News with Tim Berg.
100 million American adults are now fully vaccinated. That's nearly 40% of all U.S. adults.
By the end of May, we'll have enough vaccine supply for every adult American. In fact, just this week, we shipped our 300 millionth dose to states, tribes, territories, and federal channels.
White House COVID-19 coordinator Jeff Zients making that announcement during a news briefing. Police across the nation are mourning the death of an officer in Gilbert, Arizona. A suspect in a stolen car struck and killed one officer, critically injuring another during a wild chase involving gunfire and multiple law enforcement agencies in the Phoenix suburb. Chandler police officer Christopher Farr was killed, and a Gilbert police officer was hospitalized and is in critical condition. Arizona Governor Doug Ducey ordering flags at half staff to honor the fallen officer. USA Radio News.
America's great cities are in deep trouble. Businesses are closing, taxpayers fleeing, and police are defunded as crime and homelessness rise. It's a dangerous time in big cities like New York, L.A., Chicago, Seattle, San Francisco, and more. All this week, Rob Schmidt is on Newsmax TV, exposing the real truth in his series, Cities on Fire. Every night, Rob Schmidt gives you the real news you won't hear anywhere else. So watch Rob Schmidt tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern and see his Cities on Fire special. Newsmax TV is on all major cable systems. If you don't get it, call your cable system. Tell them you want Newsmax or you can switch. Plus, get Newsmax free on most smart TVs like Samsung, Sony, and LG. Or tune in on Roku, Pluto, Zumo, and YouTube Live. And millions have already downloaded the free Newsmax TV app on their smartphones. So start watching America's fastest-growing cable news channel. Because Newsmax is real news for real people.
A 24-year-old suspect has been detained in southern China after a stabbing incident at a local school.
Two children were killed and 16 other people were injured after a man with a knife attacked a kindergarten in southern China. Officials say two teachers were injured. The attack took place at a kindergarten in Xinfeng. Authorities say the suspect was going through a divorce and his wife worked at the school. China has experienced multiple mass stabbings at schools and daycare centers recently, including an attack in which a security guard injured 39 children and teachers at Wangfu County Center Primary School in Guangxi. From the USA Radio News Pacific Northwest Bureau, I'm Wendy King.
The process is moving forward for Harvey Weinstein to be extradited to California on sex crimes charges he faces in that state. A judge says Weinstein and his legal team have 30 days to appeal the extradition before he is transferred to L.A. You're listening to USA Radio News.
Welcome back. To get on the show, call us on James's Dime at 1-866-986-6397.
Oh, I wish I was in a land of cotton. Old times there are not forgotten. Look away, look away, look away, Dixieland. Sing it, fellas.
Oh, I wish I was in Dixie. Dixieland, it's where I was born. Early Lord, one frosty morn, look away, look away, look away, Dixieland.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back as we extend Confederate History Month one more week, and it's great to be back with you as we welcome now our final guest of this year's special series, Janice Hamblin. And she and her husband Rich have been longtime friends of TPC, and Janice joins us a couple of times throughout the year for some special events that we do here on the air. And so when we were wrapping up what we thought would be the end of Confederate History Month last week with Courtney from Alabama, Janice said, hey, you know, I happen to be born in a northern state. How about I give a perspective on what it's like to be, well, I don't want to call her a transplant. She's a southern lady through and through as far as I'm concerned. But I was thinking about it, and I said, you know what, that might be an interesting twist and an interesting addition to what we've been working on here this year. And so to help us do that now is Janice herself. Janice, thanks for the suggestion, and thanks for being with us tonight.
Well, thanks for letting me extend Southern Civil War History Month. I think it's always important. There's so many lies about the war in itself that, you know, it would take more than a month of shows to right all the wrongs.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, of course, even with a month, which is always four or five shows at most, and not dedicating even each of the full shows to it. I mean, all we can do is do our best efforts to just try to raise awareness and encourage people to go and do some further research on their own. But yeah, it's just it's a noble effort is what it is. It's not nearly comprehensive or as comprehensive as I'd like it to be. But so you heard Courtney last week, so that's the perspective of someone who was born and lived her entire life in the South. You came here at what point in your life did you become a Southerner officially?
Well, I came down to the South to finish my education in 1976. I became a resident of the state when I stayed here and started teaching school in 1978. But my actual history of kind of having some respect and love for the South started really with my U.S. history teacher class in 11th grade, believe it or not. It will warm many Southerners' hearts to know that not all Northern school kids got fed the complete lie about the South, the war of aggression in the South. I had a U.S. history teacher that actually, I mean, I can still remember him up in front of class saying, well, you know, they like to try to say that the war was because of slavery. But that was way down on the list. And what he really brought out was that the two big reasons for the war were states' rights and the tariff. And, you know, some people that, you know, and I've learned more about this since leaving school, why would a tariff be a big deal for the South? And a lot of it was, because I did learn this in school, it was cheaper for the South to send their cotton to England, have them spin it into cloth, and then buy it back as cloth than it was to get it from the North. And so for them, they got a lot of their goods from England and other European countries rather than getting it from the industrial North. So it was a big deal to have the tariff. And on top of that, most of that money that was made on the tariffs was spent on northern city, big cities, not big cities in the South, not the ones that were making them all the money. So, you know, I learned a lot from my history teacher, and in fact, he also gave us, at least he gave me, a real dislike of Sherman and his march.
You know, by the way, I just, Janice, pardon the interruption, but I just wanted to say very quickly, it's very interesting to hear you saying what you're saying, because I know you didn't have the opportunity to hear what Keith was saying just a moment ago when he was talking about the tariffs and when he was talking about the other things that you just mentioned. And with regards to Sherman, I mean, that was an early predecessor of the horrible war crimes that the United States would go on to commit in Dresden and everything else. But one thing you may not know about Sherman, a good friend of ours down here in Memphis who has been someone who has played Nathan Bedford Forrest in different productions, they have a statue of Sherman in Central Park in New York, and it's gilded. It's gilded, and you have angels, you know, emanating from his shoulders. So everything about the North, I mean, it just, compare that to the beautiful piece of art, the equestrian monument of Nathan Bedford Forrest, which I believe may be the finest equestrian monument that's ever been cast, to the tackiness of Sherman. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Janice.
But, you know, I mean, he told us of the devastation that Sherman did, and it was, you know, you kind of sit there and think, why would anybody think they have to go against civilians to win a war and destroy cities? I mean, it was just horrendous what he did. But also, he really portrayed Generals Lee and Jackson in such a wonderful light that I came out of U.S. history class as an 11th grader that those were my two favorite Civil War generals. And they've always been my two favorite. They didn't teach much about Nathan Bedford Forrest, or otherwise I would have probably had three. But, you know, I mean, you think about it. You think of their character versus Sherman's character. They were much more honorable and godly men than Sherman. They should be held up more in esteem to the American people. But they're not, and it's a shame. And a lot of it is the way that they, in history books, portray the South. And then we'll get when I did come South.
Yeah.
My parents brought me down to Chattanooga to go finish school in 1976. And on the way there, I thought, man, if they would have won the war, I would be going to a foreign country. And that whole idea kind of like, wow, that would have been really cool to be going just to a foreign country instead of just another state. But lo and behold, as I moved here, I found out you really kind of, in 1976, it was like moving into a foreign country.
I bet. Yeah, I actually want to explore this thought a little more in the next segment. This is fascinating. This was actually something that I'd had in mind to talk to you about. And that is, of course, still to this day, there is a separate culture, especially in the rural South, perhaps not as much now in the urban population centers, but in the rural South, there is no doubt that the South still today has a different flavor, a different way of life, a different standard of being that emanates from our faith and from our goodness that is separate from the rest of this country.
They certainly do. You know, we were also taught in high school that, you know, Tennessee was part of the quote-unquote the country's Bible Belt. And back in those days, it really, truly still was. I mean, it was like almost everybody went to church, you know. But, you know, the whole thing is even though a lot of people had migrated into the cities, there was still a very agrarian kind of a thought pattern to a lot of people. You know, nobody was in a big rush to go get things done.
Yes.
Everybody's in a rush up north, believe me.
Janice, you're reading off of my notes, and I promise you, ladies and gentlemen, I didn't share what I had in mind to talk to her about. We were going to get to it if we had time, but I've been teasing about an announcement for about an hour now. I do want to make a quick announcement, not so much an announcement, I guess. I just want to bring your attention to a certain organization that I think you'd do well to know. And then I want to continue this conversation with Janice Hamblin as we wrap up Confederate History Month.
Have we realized the assault against our lives, our liberties, our faith? To defeat this assault, Christians and all people of goodwill should have strategies to prevail in our faith and principles, which are simple. No need for a complex formula. One goal, one aim. A strategy like the heroic Christians of the past. We win, they lose. Nothing less. Big Q, Little Q. The Calm Before the Storm by a friend of Medjugorje. The strategy of heaven revealed. Big Q, Little Q. The Calm Before the Storm. Available on Amazon.com or by calling Caritas in the U.S. at 205-672-2000.
The Foundation for Moral Law is a nonprofit legal foundation committed to protecting our unalienable right to publicly acknowledge God. The Foundation for Moral Law exists to restore the knowledge of God in law and government and to acknowledge and defend the truth that man is endowed with rights not by our fellow man, but by God. The Foundation maintains a twofold focus. First, litigation within state and federal courts. Second, education. Conducting seminars to teach the necessity and importance of acknowledging God in law and government. How can you help? Please make a tax-deductible contribution, allowing foundation attorneys to continue the fight. You may also purchase various foundation products as well at morallaw.org. Located in Montgomery, Alabama, the Foundation for Moral Law is a nonprofit, tax-exempt 501c3, founded by Judge Roy Moore. Please partner with us to achieve this important mission. morallaw.org.
The spirit of the American West is live and well in Range Magazine, the award-winning quarterly devoted to the issues affecting the American West. Each issue contains informative articles, breathtaking imagery, as well as the culture of cowboy spirit today, and gift ideas like the 2021 Real Buckaroo Calendar. Order online from rangemagazine.com. Loving Liberty Network salutes the spirit of the American West at rangemagazine.com.
Well, my mom smokes and my dad smokes, and I saw them smoking, so I tried it. They're telling me not to smoke, but they smoke themselves.
When it comes to smoking, are you sending mixed signals?
But when you teach someone a certain way to do things, and you go back on that certain way, it sends mixed signals to the person that they're trying to teach. The parents need to be the example.
Smoking. If you think you're old enough to start, you're smart enough to stop. A public service message from this station and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
All right. right, everybody. Well, we are really wrapping up Confederate History Month tonight. No, I mean, seriously, we are, at least until next year, of course. Quick thing I wanted to tell you. There are, we were talking about this with Greg Johnson and Roger Devlin earlier in the show tonight, and what a great show it's been with those two guys and the topics we discussed, and, of course, now being able to just extend this one more week. I really felt compelled to do it. We only had four Saturdays in April, and then with this Saturday falling on the very first night of May, I just, you know, I said we're gonna go ahead and do this. But I want to remind you of the kosher question, thekosherquestion.com. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a cell phone, go to thekosherquestion.com, get that app. This organization has been a great blessing to our work here, and they are offering a very unique service, something that I wouldn't have even thought to come up with, but it is very unique. Read more about it. I mean, obviously, we've been playing the ads for years, so but I wanted to just tell you personally with my own voice during a live segment, thekosherquestion.com. You need to go there. You need to check it out. Now, there's one organization out there that I actually became aware of not too terribly long ago, and it is called the White People's Press. We've been on the air 17 years. We've interviewed all the leaders of note and of merit, and more to come, to be sure, and more come online every day. And this is a movement that is coalescing under great distress and producing great work that I think people can only do when they are being tempered and when they are suffering and facing persecution. The White People's Press. Jot down this URL, White People Press. White People, P-E-O-P-L-E, whitepeoplepress.com. They have a quarterly journal, and they are putting out some of the greatest books in terms of appearance and of content, really. I have not seen more professional output from a print outlet than this. There's a coffee table book they have entitled Folk, F-O-L-K. And it's a coffee table book. I have it on my coffee table. It offers a comprehensive and in-depth look into the topic of what it means to be a people. But it is filled with artwork and pictures of our architecture and also complemented with written words. Folks, this is just one example of what they've got over there. I don't have the words, so just check it out, whitepeoplepress.com. And we'll give you more information about them as we go forward, but I just, again, that's something I wanted to get out there tonight without taking up too much more time from Janice. Now, with regards to her experience living in the South, and this will be the definitive ending of our Confederate History Month this year, I take Janice, my wife, and children down to rural Mississippi every year to Pontotoc County, Mississippi. There is still a beautiful, beautiful Confederate square there. A monument to our ancestors is featured proudly at its center. That's where my maternal grandparents were from, this small town, just a couple of hundred people, Thaxton, Mississippi. And the inscription on the Confederate monument there reads, "Love's tribute to the soldiers who marched beneath the stars and bars and were faithful to their duty. This monument is erected in grateful remembrance." And the front simply reads, "Our Heroes, 1861 to 1865. A quaint Main Street is there in this old town, Main Street, USA. You got a couple of local shops you can visit with the rural townspeople. And then I went over to Thaxton from the Pontotoc County seat over to this small community of Thaxton, which is located on the outskirts of the county. And there is a town hall there. It's about the size of a garage, a small grocery store with a single gas pump and a Baptist church. And that's it. That's the whole town. And I take so much pride, Janice, in coming from a place like that. Now, I was born in Memphis, of course, but my immediate grandparents came from there. And even though my children can never know them, they all passed away before my children were born. But it means so much to me to be able to take them to places like that and to show them these places and to visit the graves. And I take my role as a husband and a father very seriously. It's hugely important to me that my children be raised as Christians who love and respect their ancestors. And I think that more than anything, Janice, is why we do this series. And with that, there is a different style of living in the South. I remember growing up, going down there, my grandfather playing dominoes out on the porch in front of the town hall. It's a better way of life. It's a slower-paced way of life. You were mentioning that a moment ago.
Mm-hmm.
It is the way of life we need to fight to defend. And with that, dear lady, the rest of the show is yours.
Well, I wanted to bring up two facts and then go back to that, is that up north in my little ho-dunky school, we actually learned Dixie in elementary school. It was a favorite great song. We all loved it. And also I wanted to bring out that a lot of the problems with the lack of knowledge is the kind of teachers that they have in the public school systems. When I did my student teaching, I had to listen to a teacher that I had to observe for 3 weeks before I actually started to teach myself. Had to sit there and listen to him speak about slavery for 3 weeks. This was second semester in school, and these kids had not even gotten to the Revolutionary War by February. So sometimes the problem are the kind of people that we have within our school systems anymore. And the problem, you know, parents are not that are not going and meeting their kids' teachers. They're not being involved in the schools. And I think that's one thing that needs to be done, or they just plain need to do what you guys do, homeschool, which is, I think, the best thing. But back to my own experiences is that I found out that back then people were very vocal about their dislike of Yankees. And even though I was from the Midwest, in the Midwest, we don't like being called Yankees. I'll be called a Northerner, but don't dare associate me with those New Yorkers. I'm not a Yankee.
Hear, hear.
Even Midwesterners don't like Yankees. but there was a deep rooted love of God by a lot of the people here, and the churches were flourishing and still growing. And, you know, but it would be by the late 80s, a lot of that started to seem to change. And I think that in Middle Tennessee, I think it started to happen when the Saturn plant came and when they started filling Nashville with Kurdish refugees. And then a lot of the other cities started getting all these industries. And there's a whole different flavor to life when you're a farmer or when you work in a factory. They're completely two different kinds of people. And so, you know, and the sad thing is that the South is losing its agrarian feel. And then with that, it's losing its spiritual roots, because I think when you're a farmer, you know, I have a small little garden here in our front yard, and you really have to rely on the Lord, goodness of the Lord, for the rain and the sunshine at the right time. And, you know, I've been down South for 45 years. I've seen a lot of change, and I'm sure that those that were brought up by parents that actually taught, and like your parents taking you to see grandparents that lived in this slow lifestyle, mm-hmm. that's so much better, I think, for the soul.
It's spiritual. You're right. It is, in fact, spiritual. I mean, I thanks to people like you, Janice, we've had success on this program, and that success has taken me all over the country, and I've had the ability to appear on TV and go to Times Square and do these things. But I'd rather be on a dirt road in Mississippi. I say it all the time. Give me a red dirt road in Mississippi than the streets of Times Square. And that's, I think, why those who hate us can't understand our unwillingness to abandon our customs and our symbols. This is who we are. It's personal. It's mm-hmm. spiritual.
Yep. And even if you're from the North and you are more of a farmer community, you don't like big cities. I hate big cities. Hate them. So, but that's pretty much what I had on that kind of a road, the whole thing of what I thought when I came down South, what the love of the South I already had, which is a big reason why I ended up staying too. You know, I liked it. It was comfortable. It was spiritual. But another thing I wanted to give a different observation of Gone with the Wind.
Yeah, we got about 2 minutes left. Take it away.
The sets were beautiful, the people in it were attractive, and all that stuff. But, what you know, coming from being a history major in college, what I saw was the truth in the fact that most slave owners did not mistreat their slaves. I didn't see any slave getting beat in the whole movie. You know, chided once in a while, but never beaten, never starved, nothing. And I also saw that some of these slaves were actually very loyal to the people that they were beholden to, that owned them. You know, they were very, very, very loyal. And in my opinion, it's in my opinion, a lot of this has been thrust upon the Southerners for the way the Northern industrialists treated their workers, which was much worse.
I'll tell you what we'll have to do, Janice. We'll have to pair you and Courtney up, two people who've actually seen the movie. I am still embarrassed to this day to say that I haven't seen it. But we will continue on that, and we'll always have you back. And thank you for helping us wrap up this series. God bless you. God save the South, and may God bless the South and the people who made her great and continue to make her great, people like Janice Hamblin. Love you, Janice. My best to your husband, dear friend Rich. Good night, everybody. We'll see you next week.